twice, I think. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So welcome again to class number two for Introduction to Judaism. And so I'll pass around the role chart. And we didn't have it last time officially, so you'll have the August 28th date you can check. And of course today, and no class on September 4th, so even though they put it in there, but obviously today's the 11th. So by your name, just check mark, probably a couple check marks, and well, know you're here. For Hannah's sake, I'll reiterate that I think you're a guest as well. Is that the category? Everyone's a guest. So don't let the syllabus intimidate you, because it talks about research papers and exams and all that. And that's for any, the issue is that this is I'll call it a pioneering class. They've never had Introduction to Judaism. It's not on their curriculum. So, you know, they don't have it for credit. This is just kind of elective or whatever you want to call it. But so in other words, you guys don't have to do any of that work. you can enjoy, and we'll just enjoy like we did the first class, our lecture and discussion. It's nice to have a smaller group like this for that interaction. And you know, as you read the syllabus, you can see if there's any other questions. But it does give you the readings, and even that we flip-flopped because I've been sold out of the holiday book. So as you guys know, we're going to start with the customs. So you've had 2 weeks. Hopefully you've made a little dent in the customs book. Let's see. So you don't have to take care of this now, but you didn't get books yet, I don't
think. Not yet.
Okay. These are $14 each.
Okay.
And we're using this one right now, and actually we'll follow it pretty well through our discussion here. So that after class or something. Okay, so I think we're good. Yeah, just leave that there for now. Any questions before we get into it? Yes.
I had a question. Under the triad, is there a verse for that or a section of the Bible that refers to that triad?
You know, there really isn't. I mean, you could certainly think of verses, I'm sure, you know, the learning, service of God, good deeds. There are verses for each of those, but it's not like it's a universal verse in Judaism.
Okay.
It's actually, you know, I have to admit, it's more rabbinic interpretation, right? Because while the Bible does talk about the importance of learning, hey, New Testament does, study to show yourself approved unto God, right? That kind of that attitude. And how often does God say you shall, heed these commandments, study the Torah? But again, it's not like there's a universal verse. I mean, the Deuteronomy 6:4, for sure, we talked about last time, is the declaration of faith. That is, any educated Jew would know, oh yeah, Shema, that's it, you know. But, so to answer your question, no, there's lots of verses, but not any one in particular. And so last time we did talk about the foundations of Judaism, worked our way through even the peoplehood. We covered that. So we were going to talk about a few things within point C, the community, as we start. Okay? And again, I put this section at the first of the class. We will primarily be studying customs and holy days, which I know we're all very interested in. But just to reiterate, my hope for this class, Introduction to Judaism, is that it'll be a bit broader than that, and we'll understand our Jewish friends, neighbors, how do they look at things, tend to look at things today. And, they have holidays, they have customs, but as we've been talking about, some of the doctrines, beliefs, but also, women within Judaism, children, the emphasis on children, respect for the elderly, And especially point C, we get into, I think, some interesting, boy, we've spent a lot of time on some contemporary issues that are like even hot button issues right now in our larger community. But so point C, number one there, the importance of the home. Yeah, again, there's no set verse, although plenty of many verses talking about children, teacher children. Well, there's the Shema again, Deuteronomy 6, 4, and 5. But you know, you probably know your Jewish friend well enough, and you just sense that, wow, the home life is very important within the Jewish community. It may sound funny, but even in some ways, it's more important than the synagogue life. You can have, I mean, Judaism starts at the home. That's kind of the idea. And the synagogue community is, you know, to assist that and to supplement that. I don't know, probably a lot of churchgoers probably look at it the same way. I mean, isn't the home supposed to be like the most important kind of focal point? And church is, of course, a good thing, but too many people look at the church or the synagogue as like, oh, well, we gotta send the kids to church. You know, gotta send them to Sunday school, and if they're not doing anything else for 6 days at home, or worse, home is contradicting those values, then what's the point? So obviously the best thing is to have our home life structured, you know, after God's values and the Bible, and then church is just a nice supplement to encourage that. So Sunday school is not going to magically change our kids if the home is not consistent with that. Yes?
Is it true that there's a tradition, kind of a ceremony associated with every Friday evening meal?
Yes.
And every Friday?
Every Friday night. We will talk about that with Shabbat, Sabbath, in a couple of weeks here in class. So, oh yeah. Well, that's that. I'm glad you bring that up. It's, you know, the holidays themselves are, just seem to emphasize home life. In other words, you can actually, in theory, you can have, you know, strong Jewish faith just at home. Synagogue, well, you know, it's, again, it's helpful, but Friday night Shabbat, it's at home, you know, and I mean, you have a service in the synagogue as an option, but all the holidays pretty much have home ceremonies and observances. The family unit is important, and you know, maybe sometimes a little too much. You know, plenty of Jewish jokes float around about Jewish mothers or whatever. You know, but it kind of, even that kind of reminds us, well, it's indicative that, wow, the home life is really focused in the Jewish community. And, you know, I don't know if it's, I'd say it's strong. I know it's strong in other cultures and even religions, but I don't know, this Jewish thing, as we talked the first week, there's those, that threefold identity. I mean, it's ethnic, it's cultural, it's religious. So not everyone has all three of those going. But that's why the Jewish family tends to be pretty tight. You know, it's like, hey, it's a ethnic identity. You know, you're a cultural group. It's a culture. It's also a faith, as we talked about Abraham last time.
Fiddler on the Roof has a wonderful scene about Erev Shabbat, the evening preparation, getting ready, and then having the actual ceremony, the lighting of the candles, and such a beautiful scene.
Yeah.
And the singing.
The mother goes like this, and brings the smoke,
Yes.
Yeah. It is beautiful.
Drawing in the light. So it's, yeah, we'll talk about that, those details. There's a lot of beautiful traditions, obviously, within Judaism, and some of them are directly from the Bible, so
yeah.
Even the Qalm traditions. But even those that aren't directly in the Bible, I think we're talking in this class. Forgive me if I get mixed up here. I teach a couple other classes, too. But about communion, for example, weren't we talking about that? And how most, I'll say Christians, they, oh, yeah, this is, you know, biblical, and Jesus taught it, and that, well, he did teach it. But if you dig deeper into it, it actually, there's nothing in Passover that says you should have 4 cups of wine. Nothing in the Bible, but it is in Passover for over 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So remember that. Long story short is that Jesus actually took one of the cups that is from Jewish tradition from the rabbis. Not even in the Bible. He said, this cup, do this cup in remembrance of me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I just point that out, that I mean, there's some things that are so, like, clearly Bible within Judaism, but even many things that are, quote, traditional, and some people say, oh, that's not in the Bible, it's not written in the Bible, but, well, even Yeshua, let's say that it, just because something's a tradition doesn't make it bad.
That's
okay?
True.
I mean, we all know that tradition can go south in Judaism or in Christian tradition. But, you know, if a tradition reinforces the biblical truth, then evidently it's okay. Jesus had no problem blessing that third cup. He didn't say, well, that's rabbinic. Don't do those 4 cups. I mean, he could have gone a different direction with it. So, interesting. Yes?
Well, in the reading, they also talked about the circumcision done at home, too.
But
that 8 days, that was,
that's
like,
right.
Done at home,
so,
too.
You know, it's, that's very good point. It's starts off early, and it's usually a home ceremony, and family, you know, grandparents. I mean, it's really tight. Everyone has a role. Hopefully you guys read about that. We're going to talk about that in a little bit here. So, yeah, so, well, could do a whole class on the importance of the home, but that's a general. And also, again, I'm hoping you're making the connection to not just, you know, 2,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago, but like 2017, you know, if everyone has a Jewish friend, you know, a coworker, someone you can probably think about, or even just an acquaintance. I mean, this is kind of the values of the Jewish community. It's like, you know, the home life is important, and I have to admit, some teenage Jews, like every teenager, rebels. You know, I mean, it's not like everyone's perfectly in line with it, but the values are there. And but see, isn't that important? Even as we're sharing our faith in the Lord, if we're sharing with a Jewish person, and you know, they're kind of, well, I'll put it this way: a lot of times, the issue, the biggest issue, is not even Jesus. But a lot of Jews are kind of already thinking ahead. It's like, well, wait a second, I kind of like Jesus, you know, and he's a rabbi, and wow, a Messiah. And, but if I accept him, my parents are going to freak out. My kids are going to disown me. My rabbi, for sure, you know, my community. And so if the home life is so important, somehow I just think we need to reinforce that. And I was sharing with my own, you know, mother-in-law recently, and her 86-year-old boyfriend, and she's 86, so it's not, you know, just in case you're wondering. But you know, they go to a temple up in, a conservative temple up in L.A. And anyway, it was actually a couple of years ago when her boyfriend was dying. You know, it's like hospice. And, you know, he was still very coherent, and we were just talking like this, you know, but my mom was there. And, I just felt the need to share with him that, hey, Larry, you don't have to convert. You know, if you want Yeshua, Jesus, I mean, he fits with our Judaism, and he's the Messiah, and you don't even have to switch temples, you know? I mean, you can believe in your heart, Yeshua, yeah, and receive what he has for you, and you can still go to Pasadena Jewish Temple, you know? That's not the issue, but, you know, I said that because both he and my mother-in-law, I'm sure, again, Jesus is one thing, but it's like the social implications of accepting that faith and being cut off, and, well, I, you know, and that's not even the gospel. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have to leave your family? Well, I mean, Yeshua a couple times said some challenging things, you know. What does he say? Willing, you have to love me more than,
yeah, than your
parents, your kids. Your,
yeah.
That's true. But I think we also know that, I mean, it's some weirdo cults that also take it and say, hey, you have to hate your parents now, and you have no parents, we are your parents, and just like, what? That's not what he was teaching. But obviously we have to make him our first priority. And should, I have found, you probably have too, it actually helps us connect with our family. It helps us appreciate our family when it's correct.
How was it with you and your family, your parents in particular, when you became a believer in Yeshua? And in essence, you were really following Christianity for a while. Until you came into learning more because you wanted to incorporate your Jewish heritage, mm-hmm, and beliefs and understandings and values into Christianity. Yeah. And hence Messianic Judaism is the answer.
Yeah.
So, but how was your family?
Wasn't
though?
There. As you guys attend our temple, you know some of my story. But it was pretty tense.
I can imagine.
Believer, I could tell you the whole story, but believe it or not, my mom called a psychiatrist.
Oh, really?
They thought, you know, wow, oh, are you kidding? Jesus, are you kidding me? You flipped out, got some bad pot or what, you know, what, bad acid, you know, what? How can you talk about Jesus? You know, that's how weird it sounded to them. Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, you know, she consulted with a friend of hers, a psychiatrist, and I'll just say this, the psychiatrist, and this is the dark ages. I mean, this is early 70s, obviously no email, no, and I wasn't even living at home. I was living in Hawaii, so that was kind of weird, you know, off the path too, you know, kind of the edge of the hippie movement. So I was like, oh no, what happened now? But I, you know, handwrite letters. I don't think you guys do that anymore, do you?
Sometimes.
Oh, okay. Once in a
great
while.
Keep the dream alive.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, handwritten letters and, you know, put in the post box and it goes to San Diego and you hear 2 weeks later that, you know, it's a response or something. But she took a couple of my letters to the psychiatrist and said, Doc, I, you know, this, we're really worried about our son. You know, we're Jewish and this is, you know. And guess what? Psychiatrist, she didn't even figure it out at first, but he turned out to be a believer. You know, he would be a Christian guy. So he's reading, and he says, well, you know, I think he'll be okay. He sounds pretty good, you know, and don't worry about him. This is not strange, you know. And so that reassured him. But, and then, again, the short version is that I guess it all got them interested because literally within 6 months, give or take, both my dad, my mom became believers.
Wow.
My sister's a year younger than me. So it was just like a domino effect through our family.
Right.
So, yeah, you never had a chance to meet my parents, blessed memory. But, yeah, they were part of our synagogue for many years, and they're both with the Lord now. So, but they became believers after getting over the weirdness. And but again, it goes to show you that home thing. And I don't know, I'm sure I wasn't doing everything right as a 19-year-old kid, you know, in sharing, or it's just like, hey, guess what? Jesus is the Messiah. You know.
So you were taught by your parents, the Jewish school. How did you accept him in Hawaii? That just Hawaii to me is like peace, free loving. Who told you about Jesus? You just spontaneously.
Oh, well, a bunch of people. you know, I mean, I grew up here in San Diego County, and again, some of you remember it was the Jesus movement thing. So, you know, some Christian friends were sharing with me. And then I just moved to Hawaii, and I was just a pretty serious surfer then, still surf. But, you know, part of it, in retrospect, was to hopefully get away from some of the Christians or whatever, or Jesus, and you know, move to paradise. Then I won't have to worry about all that stuff, right? Just, well, again, it's pretty complex, and it took some time, but after a while, I began to realize, you know, why... You know, I'm still not like happy totally. I mean, something's, and I here I'm in paradise. Like, why not? Well, so the Holy Spirit, I think, obviously did some work and met some believers over in Maui, and one thing led to another. So, you know, it was about a 3-year process for me. But when I was over in Hawaii, that closed the deal, and just. You know, I realized, hey, am I in or out? You know, and so made that commitment, and I am sure I didn't say the wisest things to mom and dad, but just, you know, hey, guess what? The Messiah's come. Who's that? Jesus. Oh, God. You know, that's like a Jewish parent's nightmare, you know. Almost rather have you say Hare Krishna, or, you know, yeah. I became a Buddhist, or it's like that. That's, well, okay, that's a nice philosophy, but Jesus. Listen, it's the bad history, the unfortunate history between the church and synagogue. That, yeah. In other words, Buddha is just kind of a neutral guy, you know, philosophy. But Jesus has got 2.5 strikes against him. Christianity has 2.5 strikes against it, as far as Jews are most Jews are concerned, because of the I don't know what to say. You know, most people call it Christian anti-Semitism. I don't think that there should be such a thing. How can there be? But, you know, stuff that was in the, quote, church, and I'm talking Roman Catholic Church, I'm talking Lutheran, but it's modern day, too. It's just, you know, replacement theology sounds anti-Semitic to most Jews.
Right.
Like, you know, hey, you've been replaced. It's like, well, thanks a lot. You know, I thought... God said at Mount Sinai, this covenant's forever.
Amen.
How come you know, you took... It's just a lot of bad relationship. So that's why, for most Jews, Jesus is like the one thing you cannot do. Seriously, you can become a Buddhist. There's Jewish Buddhists. There's Jewish... You can be an atheist. You're better being an atheist. Not even believing in God. No Bible, but you accept Jesus. That's like, that's the weirdest thing in the world you could do. You're like a traitor, if you can imagine. So, you know, I'm glad to say some perceptions are changing, but that's kind of the barriers we all face in sharing with the Jewish community. Okay, home life. So in other words, we're not here to break up homes. We're not here to say, hey, you know, if you want Jesus, you got to hate your parents. It's ridiculous, right? In fact, we should reinforce it that, hey, guess what? Jesus came, he came from a Jewish family, you know, and he says, love your parents and honor your father and mother.
Right.
And that's going to make sense to Jews. But they're just confused on that. Okay, I put this point in here, birth control, abortion, that's just hot button issue, obviously, but one thing to say, I mean, obviously sex is creation from God and blessed within the marriage covenant.
Correct.
You know, I mean, that's what a lot of Christians would say, too.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I don't have to tell you, there's a lot of confusion about sex and relationships today outside the church and synagogue, and sometimes even within. I mean, I have to be honest with you, the synagogue right up here in Poway has I'm not sure what the status is now. They had two lesbian rabbis, you know, living together, and they were very proud of that. You know, how tolerant we are, and oh, isn't that beautiful? And these, this is the rabbis of the synagogue.
But is that accepted?
Right here in Palo.
Is lesbianism accepted?
Oh, yeah. In certain circles, yeah. It's, like I say, there's confusion in the synagogue, some circles, and I have to tell you, in the church, there's churches that are, you know, just saying, oh, gosh, we do. God changed his mind on everything.
Okay, but is it in the Torah? Is it being accepted?
Well, that's, yeah. So those who believe in the Torah, obviously, Orthodox, the more Orthodox and conservative groups still say, hey, we want to have compassion for people, but, you know, on that topic, the LGBT, you know, homosexual lifestyle is not godly. It's not of the Torah. There's Jews that would say that, but the group, I bring up Poway because they're right across the freeway here, and they're Reform, which means they're on the liberal side of things. And so it's like, well, okay, maybe Moses said it, but that's a long time ago, and we're open-minded, and, you know, we're accepting. And so not just accepting of people in that lifestyle, but again, they're two of the rabbis in that lifestyle. Can you imagine? What's that?
You
can write them a letter if you want.
No, I'm just curious.
It's not. They just, oh, well, there's an explanation for everything. Sodom and Gomorrah is not actually sodomy or homosexuality. It's they were inhospitable. That was the sin that caused the whole city to burn. I think it must have been a little bit more than that. You know, God destroyed the whole city. So, yeah, you know what I'm saying. I'm not condoning their interpretation, but don't be naive either. There's plenty of people, groups, even religious groups, that just have changed. You know, our culture is like sand, right? And in some places, the church is not, what would you say, lovingly confronting the culture. Mm-hmm. In some places, the church is just saying, we're going to lose everyone. We better adapt to the culture. The culture impacts the church or synagogue. And I think we're all agreed here. It's like, it's supposed to be the other way around. I mean, amen. We don't have to be, you know, homophobic or whatever, but on the other hand, God help us if we give up on the moral, you know, values that are clearly taught in the Bible, both God, old and new.
God said it was an abomination.
And
it's the sin, it's the practice, not the people.
Well, that's important. Yeah, all of us. That's why sometimes I find I even have to, make it clear that because people assume, oh man, you're a minister, you're a messianic rabbi, homophobic or whatever, and they say, no, we have to love the people no matter who they are.
Yeah.
Right? And Yeshua hung out with some pretty bad people.
Pretty rough.
You know, but of course he wasn't condoning some of the lifestyles.
I guess that's what we're not to do, is condone into that.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I mean, remember the woman caught in adultery?
Yes.
Hey, who's going to throw the first stone? Everyone split. and he says, I don't condemn you, neither do I condemn you, but, of course, go and sin no more.
Right.
It's like some people want to read the first part of that verse, I don't condemn you, okay.
It's okay.
Hey,
go on, continue to sin.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess the world's never going to like that part of it. But we're here.
The worldly will not like that part.
The world. Yes, exactly. So, some of the doctrines. Well, number one, it may sound strange to you, but for example, birth control. Because Roman Catholic doctrine is really, there's a billion whatever Catholics and the Pope and all that. And you know, from the Jewish perspective, they've just had kind of weird, that's another weird thing, doctrine they've had is, I guess the Pope's trying to change things now, but it's like, you know, of course, even the abstinence of priests, you know, non-marriage,
celibacy.
In the celibacy, it's almost like sex was an evil thing. If you're really holy, you don't deal with sex. But Judaism saying, oh no, it's a gift from God, and celebrate it, and have 10 kids within marriage, and it's not just procreation. It's just like it's a gift, like the Garden of Eden, But yes, it's to be within the covenant of marriage.
Yes.
So,
how is it that two women who are homosexual lesbians can attain to a rabbi or become rabbis? They're not ordained per se.
Well, they are ordained.
They are ordained.
Yeah, by their denomination. No, they're Reform liberal denomination. Holds it up as an example. I mean, again, it's not that much difference between liberal Judaism and liberal Christianity.
Yeah.
And you guys know more about that. I mean, there's liberal denominations of Christianity that are, they'd say the same thing.
Oh,
it's like, oh man, I got a homosexual pastor. We got, it's like they actually think it's, they're being very tolerant, that whole philosophy. So yeah, they're ordained, and so it actually casts the shadow on the whole denomination.
Yeah,
not just individuals.
Same with Episcopalian and the Lutheran denomination.
It's a test these days.
Yeah.
And if you've been following the news and religious news, it's been a big debate. The Lutheran denomination has a conservative branch now and a liberal branch, Presbyterian, right?
Yes.
Same deal.
Yeah.
It's splitting denominations, Christian denominations, because of, trying to adapt. Do we adapt to the culture, or do we, stay the course in the Bible? So, it's an issue, but just be aware of that. Abortion, that's a big topic. Again, Judaism respects life. The more traditional Judaism, the more respect there is. But it's probably a bit of a shock that there are, just like in, the liberal branches of Christianity or liberal Judaism, there's like, what's the problem with abortion? And when is it life? And, that whole debate. So I'm not going to give you an answer, but I'll just say that, that's the kind of stuff in modern Judaism as well. It's ironic that abortion is legal in Israel, and conservative Jews and Orthodox Jews have called that out, and we are a nation of Holocaust survivors. How can we kill anyone? They see it for what it is, and aren't we trying? We need Jews.
Yeah.
It's like just the Nazis murdered a third of our people, and we're murdering. So, believe me, it's a heavy emotional debate in some circles in Israel. That
I didn't know that, but I'm glad to hear that. But there is at least a debate.
So, and some of these things I say with trepidation, because you can't really say, here's the Jewish belief on something. I hope you're getting the hang of this, because there's all sorts of Jewish beliefs and Jewish denominations. And it's just like you can't say, well, the Christian view is this. It's like, well, which Christian? Which denomination? Which branch? So, but if you learn that point from our studies together, that's helpful too. In fact, let me say it now. Practical things, talking to your Jewish friend or Jewish acquaintance at Starbucks or whoever you bump into, pretty early on, it'd be helpful to find out, where are they coming from? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily on these heavy topics, but just, if you're a little bit educated, like you're doing, say, oh, well, you go to the synagogue? Ask them that. A lot of Jews don't even go. That will give you a little clue, like, where, maybe where they're coming from. Or I go to, you know, such and such temple in Poway. It's like, oh, what denomination? That's Reform. You know, oh, so you're a Reformed Jew? Yeah, Reformed Jew. Or, you know, isn't that liberal, you know, and not in a bad sense, but it's just liberal philosophical. Well, to talk to a liberal Reformed Jew is going to be different than talking to Chabad. You know, Chabad is in Poway too. That's the black hat guys you probably see walking down the street.
Hasidic.
Hasidic, ultra-Orthodox. Mm-hmm. You know, they are a world of difference from the Reform. I mean, there's some commonalities, obviously, like we've been saying, but man, you have to have a whole different trajectory if you're talking to really traditional Jews versus liberal, not even, you know, God-believing people, atheist or whatever. But that helps. Good in the witnessing department, isn't it? I think that, let's see, so it's Ray, right?
Yeah.
Raymond? Go by Ray or Raymond?
Ray,
okay. Well, because you're teaching the class on apologetics?
Yes, correct? Cold case Christianity.
Cold case, yes. So, again, it's very parallel, right? I mean, it's like, certain arguments, people are asking questions, but if you want to be an effective witness, I'd say to anyone, it's not just Jews, but you know, sometimes we're answering questions that people aren't really concerned about. So I think my suggestion is to always ask questions ourselves, find out where they're coming from, save ourselves a lot of time. That's probably what you've been
doing. That's right.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me, because that's, you know, I mean, hey, we can give them our great apologetic argument on the Trinity or this, and they're not thinking about that. That's not their main issue. But if it is their issue, then let's explain it. So anyway, find out what kind of person you're talking to.
Yes.
In the Jewish community, it's like there's a whole spectrum of differences. So, and you know, actually, I encourage you to meet. I know you say the word witnessing, and it usually strikes fear in people's hearts.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But to me, it's just carrying on a dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, I tell our own people, I say, guess what? I hope it's fun. Fun? Crap, are you kidding me? You know, it should be fun just dialoguing with people. You know, it takes the pressure out of the argument if we're not just trying to convert them the first 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Hit them with, you know,
hit
Bible.
Them with a,
yeah, it's just like, you're Jewish, great. You know, so you go to temple, where do you go? Does your family celebrate Shabbat at home? Or, you know, and hopefully in the course of our studies, you get a little more Jewish understanding, and oh man, you'll have fun talking to them. You say, hey, yeah, we're studying about Passover, and that third cup is very interesting. Is it true you had the third cup at your Seder? And then, you know, it just asking them, you know, I mean, it's just human nature, isn't it? We sincerely get a dialogue going, and people feel respected. You're not just a notch on their belt. You know, people feel it's like, oh, this guy's trying to convert me. You know, it's just like, no, tell me a little bit about Judaism. And then guess what? I mean, you will enjoy learning a little bit from your Jewish acquaintance. And don't be surprised when they start then asking you, but, well, wait a second. Now, where'd you learn about Tanakh? Where'd you know that term from? We had this wacky rabbi come and teach us a class. And, you know, it's like one thing leads to another. And Maranatha, I know you guys sound the shofar, right? The Rosh Hashanah. Just what a great testimony. You know, to say, oh, yeah, you know, we're a Christian church, but guess what? We know we're connected, and we sound the shofar at the new year, and then
celebrate the feasts.
You know, for a lot of Jewish people, that's the important witness that they can handle for the moment. You know, they may not, they may just run out the door if you start talking about Jesus directly, but you know, it shows an appreciation for them, and like something's different here. Like, these guys, you know, why are they learning about Judaism? Why are they learning about my faith? I thought they were against my faith. And so can you see where that would just open people up?
Yeah.
So I just, and the good news is that we live in a day when more and more people are dialoguing. I mean, talking. Sometimes it's been forced on us, right, with the weird culture we're in. But you know, I mean, we've had the talk about Islam. And it's not also Islamophobia. It's like I like talking to Muslims. Just, hey, you know, oh, wow, we're Muslim, I'm Jewish, hey, mazel tov, you know, and then, you know, salam, you know, and I kid you not, I mean, just, I isn't that funny how the Lord works, but we need we're getting some bids for a roof on our home, and, you know, okay, we'll call a couple guys, we'll send someone out, so some company, yeah, I mean, just generic company, San Diego company, and of course, who shows up? This guy, Mustafa, or whatever his name was, you know. I mean, totally involved in the Islamic Center. You know, nice young guy. And so I say, oh, that's interesting. You're in a rabbi's house, and here we are. So we had a nice little discussion about the roof and then about religion. And I'll tell you what, we live in a day, I really encourage everyone I talk to, welcome the dialogue.
Right.
You know, we had enough walls and just, you know, fear. And, you know, I think people are beginning to realize that, you know, we better, and we're the ones called to build bridges.
Yeah.
You know, we can't wait for the Jewish guys to say, hey, please tell me about Jesus. Please explain the whole thing to me. No, they are got barriers. Yeshua said, you go. Right? The Great Commission.
Right.
So, proactively to build some bridges, and I don't know, we may have to rethink our witnessing a little bit. And it's not just an automatic Bible verse, but we're sharing principles, we're sharing who we are. The Jewish people, I admit, it's just a weird kind of witnessing. It's different than most other people. So, okay, well, let's push on. A couple other points that we're going to get into customs. But alcohol, just a word on that. I don't know. I just threw these points in here previous class. But probably no surprise, alcohol is not like a evil thing. Frankly, I don't think it is in the Bible. And I don't know how everyone in this room looks at it. Of course,
he just says not to be a drunkard.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
It's okay to drink, but if you're going to continue to be out and be out of control, then you shouldn't.
That's the point. Very good, Enrique. So it's, yeah, don't let other things control us is basically it. So, which also applies. I mean, oh, man, I really am fearful about this marijuana thing, you know. You can legalize it, tax it, do whatever. It's just like, that's all we need is some more. It's not enough to have all the DUIs on the highway, you know. It's
not that you're going to have all the
pot guys. And oh, but it doesn't hurt you. It's not addictive. You could argue against that, but it's just foolishness.
It's a gateway to other drugs. And that's
no doubt about it.
To be
no doubt. And but, you know, again, I think it's probably become less of an issue, like alcohol, understanding that moderation view that Jews have always been there. It's just like every holiday we're blessing a glass of wine, and every Friday night, glass of wine. And but you know, it's interesting, historically speaking, Enrique, right?
Mm-hmm.
It illustrates what you said. While Jews had no problems with wine or alcohol in that degree, the worst thing in the community is a drunkard. You know, so, I mean, that was like, there's even, you know, bad Yiddish words for such a person. which is interesting because like everyone's drinking, but oh, that guy just can't, you know, didn't handle it right, and he's abusing it, and so, but that kept. I'm sorry to say, in probably our generation, things are not so consistent as they were. Like my parents, my grandparents' generation, you would have been hard pressed to find a Jewish, I'll say, alcoholic. Really. Because the whole community was against it, you know? Again, that's 100 years ago, 50 years ago. Now, there's just as many Jews in rehab and all that. I think, unfortunately, you know, kind of went with the culture. But it's just a point worth mentioning because some people I bump into still say, oh, alcohol, oh, man, don't, you know, I'll never take a drink of that. Jewish, they're thinking, well, what's wrong with them? You know, that's kind of overboard, but...
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
The Europeans, they seem like when they let their younger kids taste wine and stuff at a younger age, but they dilute it. When you have your ceremonies and they do certain things with wine, do the kids get a taste of
some,
the wine too?
Sometimes. I mean, because we're talking about a half ounce of, you know, Manischewitz... tastes terrible, by the way. It's like it's a deal. So you're not going to want a whole glass of that stuff. But you know, there's kosher grape juice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, at our synagogue, even every week,
yeah.
We fully respect. There are people that come from alcohol addictive background, and man, God bless them for finding victory and, you know, walking with the Lord, and last thing we want to do is stumble with someone like that. So, but, you know, for us it'd be strange just to have grape juice for the blessing of the Sabbath. So we have both. And, you know, most people, virtually everyone is happy with that, but that's an interesting point, yeah. I think last time you were saying you lived in Europe for a while.
And I met people who had kids, and the kids were able to. Never really met a Jewish person go in the house to see if they do the customs with their kids like that. There's no alcohol problem that we have here in the United States.
I'm just wondering, is
it the same thing in Israel? Is there alcohol problem because the kids don't have the restrictions like we have here?
It's a very interesting question. Again, I think there's, unfortunately, the Jewish community is kind of, you know, had its own struggles in recent years, you know, addictions, alcoholism. There, you can find that in Israel. It's rather shocking, you know. But I'm talking like 4,000 years of history. That was kind of the philosophy. And yeah, it's interesting that when I've been to Europe and I've taught in Europe, and I remember going out to you know, teaching a service, where was it? In Moscow or somewhere. You know, I've been some of those places. And afterwards, okay, right, we're going out for lunch, and what do you want, vodka or beer? And these are Christians. I'm going, well, I'm not having vodka. That's what, you know. But, and they're just, you know, and it's like a Bible study. They're all drinking beer, and just like it's cultural.
It is cultural.
It's kind of shocking that. Yeah, I think I had chuckle. Americans, we're kind of, for all the open-mindedness we think we have and liberal that we think we have, we're actually a pretty conservative society still as a whole, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's evolving. But
wasn't the wine back then to calm the stomach down?
True. I mean, you're lucky if you could drink the water, right? Mm. So it was... you know, a necessity. It was medicinal many times.
Same point in Europe. The water is no good in certain parts of Europe, so you have to drink.
Yeah.
Wine was cheaper than soda.
That's right.
Beer was cheaper than soda. Wine and beer was much cheaper than a $5 thing of water that could have been this small.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm wondering if...
Well, it's just interesting. It's pretty much cultural stuff. Of course, the bottom line, like we said, anything that's controlling of us is not of God. So, I mean, you can say alcohol, you can say gambling, you can say drugs, you could say whatever, that pretty much covers it. But the Jews don't think of alcohol for sure as an evil. Okay, medicine is good. We're kind of talking about that. Again, I shouldn't even have to say that, but there's, I don't know how some of these strange groups out there feel no blood transfusions, no medicine, that God will heal us. It's just like, wow.
Is that Jehovah Witness who believes in that?
Aren't they? Yeah, they're one of the groups, right?
Yeah, my brother, he's actually a Jehovah Witness.
Christian Science, I think, right? There's groups like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate. It's a misunderstanding, misapplication of the scripture. So you guys know that. Capital punishment. Okay, last biggie. I'm taking all these light issues here, but capital punishment. It may surprise you. The state of Israel does not have capital punishment. Well, I take that back. There was one case. One person has been executed by Israel in its 69 years. The mastermind of the Holocaust and the death camps back in the 1950. Yeah, he was finally captured, put on trial, and they reserved the right to hang him in Jerusalem. But that shows you how extreme it is. Think about that. No, I mean, there's certainly capital offenses, and again, I can read your guys' minds. Hey, what the Bible says, someone takes a life, take it, But so that's why I bring it up, because actually Judaism, even the traditional branches of Judaism say, well, okay, the Torah says it, but it's just such a holy thing, awesome thing to think about taking the life of an individual. I mean, I'm talking about a court, capital punishment, execution, that the rabbis just historically, basically the last 2,000 years, because there's too many, life is life, and what if there's a slight chance the court is wrong?
True.
Isn't that interesting that, what do they call it now, Project Innocence or something? And now that we have DNA capability and they're going back, and you read about all the times, like, yeah, some guy's been in prison for 20 years, ready to death row, and he's innocent. So it's interesting that Judaism has pretty much taken that view the last 2,000 years, that they're not denying that it was terrible, that this person's guilty of murdering someone, but who are we to take the life of anyone? And, I'm not saying I even agree with that, but if you happen to get on the topic of capital punishment with the average Jew, you might be surprised to say, oh, no, we don't believe in capital punishment. It's like, well, it's in the Bible. Well, no, that's old stuff. And
so there's no jail?
Just what it is.
There's no jails in Israel?
Oh, yeah. There's life imprisonment. There's plenty of prisons if you need it. And they need it. There's criminals, and they... But yeah, life in prison versus... I'm talking about capital punishment, executing someone. It's against the law in Israel, except Adolf Eichmann was such a notorious case that he's the one person.
Wasn't that kind of Yeshua's teaching too? I mean, the woman, caught in adultery was, could have had capital punishment according to the Torah, and then stoned to death. But he said, and let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Well,
and there was nobody there that, could cast the first stone.
Interesting.
I've often thought about that. I think it was his way of teaching that the emphasis on capital punishment for certain offenses was probably misplaced, and that her sin didn't rise to the level of capital punishment.
Yeah, but that,
it's not stated. Yeah, I know.
But
well, it's been pointed out, by the way, that that particular incident, I think maybe Yeshua was wondering why the man wasn't brought in at all.
Exactly.
So yes, kind of, maybe that was
yeah.
the problem.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, why are you condemning this woman? I mean, it takes two.
It's
and
like she was set up to go there to show the rest of the crowd what Yeshua was about.
Yeah.
Because they saw him as, in one hand, very conservative, and the other hand, very liberal.
Yeah. It's an, that's a deep question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the capital. Because on the one hand, you know, we the Torah itself, courts of law and justice, mm-hmm. and, but boy, you know, life. Now we're dealing with, what's it called? Legalized euthanasia.
Yeah.
You know, here in California.
I know.
I was reading, there's a couple hundred people that have taken the offer since the law passed, it's a couple years now or something.
Yeah.
Of course, been up in Oregon and all, but it's like, even for Judaism, that is not allowed. I mean, so it's all kind of the same principles. Like, hey, God gave us life, and you just hang in there until God takes you.
Yeah.
And who are you to even take your own life?
Right.
That's pushing God out of the equation.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, again, for better or for worse, they say who even a justice or a judge, a trial, a jury, you know, who are they to ultimately say that we're taking your life? Even a guilty criminal, you know, they're not denying guilt. It's just like life is from God and let's let God deal with it.
Amen.
So it's just, it's really a deep topic. Think about it.
It is.
So
are those concepts in the rabbinic writings?
Yes.
And did they start, like when did, say, the one against capital punishment, it had to start sometime after the time of Christ, but do you know roughly when that might have started?
It was pretty much the time of Yeshua. So if you, if you guys want an interesting book, extra credit book, you might want to find, you can write this down if you want. It's a book I recommend on the topic. It's called Every Man's Talmud.
Talmud, that's the word I was thinking
of.
I couldn't
Talmud remember. Is the rabbinic commentary. So Every Man's Talmud. I think we've used it in other classes here, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Cohen is the, I think it's Abraham Cohen is the editor. Of course, the Talmud, and it's excellent because it's like one paperback, you know, pretty solid paperback book, but it's so interesting because he arranges it in English, that's helpful, the topics, and then he actually has a, you know, 5-page section on what does the Talmud say about capital punishment,
uh-huh.
and why did they have that philosophy,
mm-hmm.
so I think that's a book if you're, and you can look up, 100 topics, more than that, you can, what does the Talmud say about sin? What does the Talmud say about the Messiah? It's got a section on that. And it's fascinating because it's all the rabbinic stuff. So, but to answer your question, Ray, it developed, it probably, there's some references you'll find about being opposed to capital punishment sometime around the time of Yeshua, right during that first century era. And in fact, there's one first century rabbi, I don't think it's Hillel, but it's one of those other rabbis, who actually, it's interesting because he actually boasts. And he says, well, I've been part of the Sanhedrin court for, you know, 30 years, and we have not put one person, you know, to death, condemned one person to death. And he's boasting about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's first century. So anyway, you can check that out. And
mm-hmm.
It's interesting how that develops.
Never mind. I can ask some other.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and that's just kind of some issues on the overview of modern Judaism and how Jews tend to look at some issues. Now again, we because the book wasn't in the holiday book, we were going to start on the Jewish life cycle, page 4, is it, of your outline? Because I presume you got to read some of that in the last couple of weeks. So we'll take the syllabus a little bit out of order, but we'll get back to the holidays. And the customs, Jewish life, and divide into two parts. One is the life cycle, meaning stages of life, events that mark certain stages of life. Very interesting to see what they are in the Bible and how Judaism applied them, still applies them. And then a secondary part would be Jewish, I call it lifestyle, which is tradition like the dietary laws and prayer shawl, and head covering, those kinds of things. So that's what that Jewish customs book is about. And so we'll jump right into it. Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe a good time for our 7-minute break, I guess, before we start a whole main topic. So
Okay. It's
already a little after 8. Yeah. So I like to call it the 7-minute biblical break, right? So feel free. I saw some cookies down there. I may go grab one a little bit.
Yeah, sounds like
if that's for us. So, okay. And you all have books. You can take care of that if you need to.
Okay,
so this is part 2 of our class, number 2, Introduction to Judaism. Again, your name is?
Anita.
Anita was asking about if possible to visit our services, you know, our synagogue, and I definitely, I think it's kind of a field trip homework assignment I'd like to make. So, any of you are welcome anytime. Keep us in prayer for sure, because we have the High Holy Days coming up, starting a week from Wednesday is Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year, and and actually, I didn't even think about, but I can bring some more. But boy, what a practical application. We have tickets for the High Holidays. And, you know, our services are free and open. We do ask for reservations just so we know kind of who's coming and how to prepare, because we don't quite have the size sanctuary that Maranatha does. But, and plus, in the Jewish community, here's a little learning curve. They're used to paying for tickets for the High Holidays. You know, like, number one, you probably pay a dues to join a temple.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, it may sound a little tacky at first. You know, it's like, oh, you got to pay dues to belong. And then you pay for a ticket like this for, like, one synagogue was $360, to come to services. But that's the way you do it. It's not as bad as it sounds, because on the other hand, synagogue never passes the plate for an offering. So, because think about when their Jews are meeting, it's Shabbat, Sabbath, and handling money and all that kind of stuff for a lot of people is not done. So it kind of evens out. In fact, I think the Jewish guys probably come out a little bit ahead, cheaper to pay a couple thousand dollars a year. I mean, you guys are probably tithing more than that, but anyway, all that to say is I wish I had some for everyone, but if you have a Jewish friend that you think you might like to invite, I have 3 tickets.
I have
tonight,
two more.
So you got a Jewish friend. Oh, do you? Oh, good. Good. Well,
one.
Let's just give everyone at least 1 ticket.
Yeah. She gave me one.
Okay.
Is this 1 ticket per person?
So
there you go.
Yes.
So the deal is that you guys don't even need that really. I mean, you can, if you're coming to one of those services on the card, those are, packed out High Holiday services. You can call and just say, "Hey, I'm in Rabbi's class," and put my name on the reservation list. But that ticket is just a handy way to invite a Jewish friend. Again, we wish we could have everyone in Maranatha come, but no way. So, it's really, it's a Jewish outreach is what it is. You guys, since you take this class, you're most welcome to come. And wouldn't it be cool if you...
What does a female wear?
Oh, it's, I'd say semi-dressy for San Diego style. You know, in other words, not this stuff, you know, short sandals. I guess sandals could work a bit. You know, I'd say most ladies would be in a skirt at least, and, you know, kind of, it's not formal, although some guys will be coat and tie and that kind of thing. The synagogue does tend to be a little bit more formal than the average church. Certainly Maranatha, I know.
So. Used to be the churches were very formal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Used to be. Pastors would be formal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only been the last 25, 30 years where the dress code seems to be relaxed and they go in jeans and they dress like that they're going to the beach or something.
Yeah. I would like that.
Yeah. Great.
Well, if you came out of Hawaii.
And I'm casual here tonight. I was up in L.A., so I said, I'm just wearing shorts all day. But
that's great.
No, don't have to wear any head covering. Just kind of, what's the word? Casual dressing.
Modest, yeah.
Yeah.
Modest.
So, but, and you know what? Those little tickets, even if your Jewish contact doesn't come to the service or they don't even want the ticket, it will probably open up just a little dialogue, you know? Say, oh, gosh, wow, it's a free ticket. Oh, Messianic? No thanks, you know? But, yeah, please tell them it's Messianic so they don't think they're coming to, you know, Beth Israel or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, they might come. We have a lot of Jewish visitors on the high holidays. Because, you know, the Jewish community is kind of programmed. It's like, you know how it is, like Christmas and Easter.
Yeah,
it's like Rosh Hashanah, I got to go to synagogue somewhere. Even if they're not that religious or they don't go any other time. So if you happen to talk to a Jewish friend or neighbor and say, hey, guess what, I got a ticket here and I think I'm going to go to service. Would you like to come with me? That'd be the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even tell them that. I've never been to the synagogue, but, you know, we have a class with the rabbi, and, you know, that'll probably even help them, put them at ease. Even if they don't be surprised, they may turn it down when they find out it's Messianic, or they may say, Messianic, what is that? Hey, there's your witnessing opportunity. So.
Jewish. Cold case Christianity.
Yeah.
Cold case Jesus.
Does your book go over what the sacraments and rituals are?
You can fast forward. I wrestled with this because we could still do the holidays. I think maybe we'll take it piecemeal. Maybe like next week we'll even talk about Rosh Hashanah because that's right before the holidays. It seems very appropriate. But I know you were reading on some of the other things. But you can, well, I'll go ahead and assign it for the next week. Why don't you read it? It's in the syllabus about the spring holidays.
Right.
So I think it's.
But you want to start with Rosh Hashanah.
It'd be the same pages, yeah. Spring holy days, it says. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So it's page 1 through 62 in the new book, God's Appointed Times.
Okay.
So if you can, you know, some of you, that's a lot of reading, but you can, it's the first three chapters, I think, of God's Appointed Times.
Well, Rosh Hashanah starts at page 63.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. So, thank you. So actually, it would be the second.
Second. Yeah, that's chapter 5 at page 63.
Yeah, so page 63 through 106.
Okay.
All holy days, of course.
So we're going to do that first and then the spring holy days?
Yeah. Okay. We might as well do that because that's what's happening in the next couple of weeks.
Right.
In the Jewish community. So read about the fall holy days for next time.
Okay.
And we'll have a good discussion there.
A lot of people are thinking that there's going to be a rapture.
I know. Well, hey, you know, shofar, trumpets. It sounds like we should be ready.
I won't be ready. He's terrible.
Yeah. And we sound the shofar. Oh, gosh, you guys will like it. I know you guys do that here at Maranatha.
Yeah, we do.
But obviously, we're going to be a little more traditional on it. I mean, we got liturgy. It's a synagogue, don't be surprised, synagogue service, but including Jesus.
Will it be like in Hebrew?
A lot of it's in Hebrew, but it will be translated so everyone can follow along. You know, even someone that knows a lick of Hebrew. So, don't be surprised. It's Hebrew. It's 50-50 Hebrew, English. It's Torah scrolls. We really are. I mean, this is our vision. It sounds kind of crazy, but we think it makes sense. You know, it's a synagogue for Jesus. You know, it's some people say, "Oh, well, you're a church that has some Jewish stuff." No, but you can hear the difference. It's a synagogue. I mean, we don't even have Sunday service. We don't even. You know, we're not anti-Christmas or anything, but we don't have Christmas. We don't have Easter. It's the Jewish calendar, Jewish holy days, and of course, my proposal, and you'll see it in the book, is that hey, Yeshua is all over that. You know, he is in every holiday. He's always been there. So I know you're the kinds of guys that would really enjoy it, especially. Call it Rabbi Barney's Revenge a little bit, because it's a kind of going to be a little culture shock. I mean, I had culture shock. I could tell you some funny stories when I started attending church. It's just like, you know, if you hadn't thought of that, it's like, wow, a Jewish guy starts going to church. It's not very natural, you know. It's like even the day's different, right? Yeah. Sunday was felt a little different. I was like, well, I guess it's not Shabbat anymore. You know, again, Christmas, Easter. I think there's a lot of beautiful things to it, but it's just different.
Yeah, it is.
I'll tell you one story. I remember early on, I was attending a church, and I mean, I was just a new believer, you know, baby believer. So I'm still trying to figure things out. And as I recall, one week they said, next week we're gonna have whatever they called it, communion, mm-hmm. the Lord's Supper, mm-hmm. Lord's
yeah,
Supper.
Lord, yeah.
That's a good church, you know, here in San Diego County. But I asked my Christian, what's that? It's kind of like Passover. I thought, oh, cool. So, you know, came next week. I was hungry, you know, ready to eat the full meal. And we started passing around this little wafer thing. I said, wow, you know, like kind of cheapskates around here. A little thimble went around with grape juice. Talk about culture shock.
It's yeah, like, that was.
I said, what happened to the matzo ball soup? What happened to the, you know? So there's I had culture shock getting used to, you know, and just cultural stuff. And so that's why I say it tongue in cheek. It's the revenge of Rabbi Barney. You know, you guys will be going Hebrew. Oh, yeah, you know, and kind of. Lost maybe a little bit on a couple of the details, but you'll get it, and that's translated. And so you're welcome to come without a friend, but please pray about someone you can invite. If you don't even know anyone, keep it with you for the next 10 days, the next 20 days, and you never know who you will run into. So
I can say this: the dance and worship music are all beautiful. And they all point to our Lord and Savior, talking about what He did for us in song. And the first half of the service is a lot about that.
Yeah, so, and again, chalk it up to an educational experience. I know you guys are plugged into Maranatha, and I love this church and Pastor Ray, so definitely not, you know, quote recruiting anyone, but it's more like an educational field trip.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, that you've attended before, right?
I was going to, but I didn't think I'd have.
Yeah, these guys have, and of course, part of us. And so, anyway.
I remember, so excited.
Yeah, well, please. And our service, you can go on our website. You have our name. Well, it's on your syllabus, too, KHLOT-REL. And every Saturday, if it's just a Saturday morning you want to come by, you're welcome to do that. Okay, well, let's talk some Jewish life cycle. And as you saw in the book, God's Appointed Customs, it starts with what's called Brit Milah, Covenant of Circumcision. And interesting place to start, this custom of circumcision. You know, we have the scripture there and in Genesis. You guys know the basic story. Abraham called to, we talked last first class about, you know, Abraham and his calling, new nation, new land, etc. But interestingly, it's not till Genesis 17, a few chapters later, that God says, here is a sign of the covenant. And I have a verse in the book. It's page 9 of the book, if you have that handy. And, of course, he says, you are to keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, generations to come. This is my covenant with you, covenant you should keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And then, it says, lower, for the generations to come, every male circumcised who is 8 days old. Okay?
In Genesis, what is that?
17.
Verse 9 through 13,
yeah.
Okay.
And so the basic deal, notice some people can confuse it. They say, oh, circumcision, you know, the little operation on a male, that's a covenant. But if you look carefully, he calls it in the Bible the sign of the covenant. So in other words, the covenant is the Abrahamic covenant. What God spoke to Abraham, Genesis 12. You know, new, I'm making you a people, bringing you to a land, etc. And but this would be the sign of the covenant. Interesting, as you go through the Bible, whenever God makes a covenant, there's a sign, some kind of marker associated with it. You know, Passover, and even you could say New Testament, right? Sign of the covenant. Do this in remembrance of me. Well, for Abraham, this was it. And as strange as it sounds, 8 day circumcision for the boys. Now, circumcision was not like totally unknown. In fact, it was probably pretty well known in the ancient world. Even in Abraham's time, we know the Egyptians had the custom, other peoples. But that's why I think God says on the 8th day. Well, two things. Number one, it's the 8th day, and secondarily, it's all boys circumcised. The Egyptians, for example, it was the priesthood that was to be circumcised. That was it. That was their sign of the covenant, whatever. So it's interesting. I mean, it's not like maybe it was an unknown tradition, but the 8th day is a unique thing, and we could get spiritual about that. You know, 7 days is completion, 8 is kind of a number of new beginnings, right? So it makes sense after the 7 day week. So, it's kind of like, oh, new beginning in a baby boy, you know, the first 7 days, 8th day, they're circumcised. Of course, and that would make it different from Egyptian or Assyrian or anyone else who would follow the custom. 8th day is the Jewish tradition, sign of the covenant. And, you know, in the book I talk about the nitty-gritty details of the ceremony. It's interesting. I mean, you got, it's a rabbi, you know, a mohel, it's called, and you can check out the terms. All the families involved, it's, you know, it sounds kind of you know, almost a little bizarre, but it's like, wow, you know, we're going to have a big party around this circumcision of the boy. But that's it. It's a celebration of family and new life. And it's a sign of the covenant. So this boy is, I'll put it this way, the boy is Jewish by birth. I mean, you're Jewish by lineage and those things we talked about. But God says, take the sign of the covenant. Sign of the covenant. So to put in reverse, there's certainly cases, even in the Bible, where Jewish kids weren't circumcised. It's not like you become Jewish at your circumcision, but it's a sign of what you already are. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it carries over all the way to the New Testament, by the way. I think of Timothy in Acts chapter 16. I don't know if you ever noticed that. It's kind of a strange, why is this circumcision of Timothy brought up in New Testament? Well, it would be strange, but we're told, you may recall, that Timothy's mother was Jewish. Mm-hmm. His father was a Greek. The proverbial intermarriage, I guess you'd say, and for whatever reason, he was not circumcised as a kid. Maybe his dad wasn't Jewish, his mom wasn't that religious. But if you check out Acts 16, Paul says, oh, okay, well, you're a messianic leader now. You're going to help me, Paul. So you had Timothy circumcised, sign of the covenant. It's just very interesting. So that is in the New Testament. I mean, I think circumcision, even, you know, there are those who say, oh, wow, you know, once Jesus comes, that's all that stuff's done. Doesn't matter if you're Jewish or not. Doesn't matter circumcision. In fact, watch out. Don't get, you know, legalistic, whatever. But, I think it's just a natural understanding to say, hey, there's still the covenant of Abraham. And so, to put it kind of in common language, if someone is born Jewish, even today, a boy, you know, they should, if they can, the parents should have them circumcised on the eighth day as a sign of the covenant. And we Messianic Jews, you know, I mean, I've got four kids, two boys, and both boys were circumcised on the eighth day. It's like, you know, and they are, of course, it's before they came to faith, but they're in a Messianic Jewish family, and it's not opposed to our faith in Yeshua as the Messiah. It's just a sign that, hey, we are still Jews. In fact, I think it's important for that reason. There's still Jewish identity, and the promise of Abraham is going forward. I think it'd be kind of sad if this has been a problem, actually, in I'll say my denomination, is that some people think that, oh, I accepted Jesus, and oh, thank God I don't have to be Jewish now, you know, almost. And they drop they're born Jewish, but they drop it. And it's like, no, the way we look at it, the remnant of Israel needs to be identifiable and stand up. It's good to have Jewish people visible that believe in Jesus. I mean, you know, put it the other way, if every Jew that accepts Jesus stops being Jewish, I mean, the Jewish community says, well, it's not for me, you know. But anyway, if you hadn't thought about it, probably not, but circumcision is actually still an important ceremony for Jewish boys, even Messianic Jewish families. And I won't bore you with the whole, you did read about all the details of, you know, the grandmother comes in, the godfather does this, but it's the main point is that it's a home ceremony and it's a celebration of life. And it is God who says, you know, the first life cycle event is 8 days old for a boy. So, and there's the naming of the boy at that point. Today in modern Judaism, I mean, Jews here, let's say in San Diego County, I mean, like we did with our boys, they've got their given English names, but then you get your Hebrew name. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's And guess what? Well, as I bring up in that chapter, let's see, the naming, well, isn't it interesting that Luke chapter 2 talks about the circumcision of Yeshua himself, right? His parents, put in those terms, were traditional Jews, and of course, I mean, it's just like, no question, they're going to have that circumcision ceremony, and it mentions it in Luke chapter 2.
What verse do you know?
I'm looking right here. 57, excuse me. That's John the Baptizer. Luke 2:21 is Yeshua. And you read this verse from understanding some of the Jewish culture. I'll read it. It's at the bottom of page 18 if you're in the book. On the eighth day, when it was time for his Brit Milah circumcision, he was given the name Yeshua, which is what the angel had called him before his conception. Isn't that interesting? Short, but perfectly consistent with Jewish tradition. He wasn't given his name officially till the eighth day.
Yeah.
Even Yeshua. And I point out about John the Baptist, you know, as well, is named. So it carries over to the New Testament. It's just the sign of the covenant. And now I do need to bring up, it's funny, I just preached on this last Shabbat at our service, Acts 15. The controversy was not, in the New Testament, was not about Jews still following the practice of circumcision as believers Yeshua, but the controversy was, do the Gentiles have to be circumcised? Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's pretty crazy, you know? I mean, by our way of thinking, but it reminds us of basically how Jewish that early movement was in the book of Acts. I mean, you know, you non-Jewish guys, you were way outnumbered, you know, and all the Jewish community, the believers, were following the customs, and yet, as God predicted, you know, the Gentiles would come in, and that's all God's plan. But isn't it interesting? They had to struggle with that question. Some of the, I'll call them conservative Messianic Jews, it says Pharisees, Messianic Jews, said, hey, obviously these Gentile guys are coming in. They're, no question, they got to be circumcised. You know, because that's what Judaism teaches. That, everyone will be happy to know that, you know, the answer. They had the Jerusalem Council, the whole deal, and
right.
And they decided, no, that's not part of the gospel, not necessary for, obviously, for salvation. Now, if you read Acts 15, they actually highlight four things they do ask of the Gentiles. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember what they are?
Idols.
No idols. Well,
no,
okay.
Strangled meat.
No strangled meat, that's a strange one. But again, they're coming from a pagan background.
Right.
And coming to the God of Israel and the Jewish people, basically, grafted in. So I think he's saying be sensitive to the Jewish part of things.
Right.
No sexual immorality.
Right.
That was a problem in the pagan world. Say, hey, if you're coming to the God of Israel, repent, you know, there's right way to do things. No blood, which most interpret as murder, no murder. So, but interesting, what they don't mention, well, they specifically say circumcision is not required. But that's how important the issue was even in the first century. So as you read the chapter, I even have a order of service. I'll tell you what, it's quite beautiful to have a baby boy born in our community, and you understand, we're not talking salvation at all or anything, but it's just saying, hey, this boy's taking the sign of the covenant, and it's really the parents that are doing this, right? The kid doesn't know what's happening. Fortunately.
Yeah. At eight days old, my goodness.
That there's wisdom, and maybe that's why God said the eighth day instead of 17 years or something.
When I worked at the hospital, I saw a circumcision done on a baby boy, but it was within 24 hours. Because you don't keep babies in that long. So.
Well, that's true. Good point, Anita. That, and we all know that, think about it, it's I don't know what the common philosophy is now. The hospital, the medical community has gone back and forth. It seems like they change their mind every 10 years. Circumcision is good. You know, it protects the baby, the boy, and even later in life. And I mean, there's been studies, by the way, like certain kinds of cancers. And,
right.
And even, guess what? I saw one study, cervical cancer, women married to circumcised men as like protected. It's like, well, that's interesting. Back when, well, we still have HIV and AIDS, talk about that. So but the medical community kind of comes and goes. Then, you know, 10 years later, they say, oh, no, no, that's torture. Don't do that to the kid, you know, and there's no reason to do it.
Now, there's a group of women that organized against circumcision. And because it hurts the baby, that's the issue.
Yeah.
But whole list of other negatives about it, so they're taking on this cause.
Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of like
a couple of nations in Europe. I don't know if you heard it. I mean, they're trying to outlaw circumcision, and the Jewish community. Can you imagine that? I mean, but. But it really doesn't matter. I'll say for, let's take it in America here, whatever the hospital is, I mean, a lot of people, not Jewish, they opt for, oh, want the baby circumcised? Yeah, okay, and that second day, first day, circumcised. But again, maybe that's why God said eighth day, because you really have to go out of your way to make that happen. And even, I was talking, one of our families, you know, they're over at Kaiser or something, had a baby boy. It's like, well, we're going to have an eighth-day circumcision. I said, oh, no, you can't do that here.
Yeah.
It's like, what? And we're Jewish. We're religious. On
yeah. That. My son, he was born 2 months ago. In the hospital, they don't do circumcision. You have to go to your gynecologist's office, and they do the circumcision.
Yeah.
But you have to pay a pretty big
amount. At a gynecologist's office?
Yeah. Isn't that odd?
I was at a teaching hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I was at Johns Hopkins Hospital doing my internship. And they pulled us in. The kids is like, "You want to go see a circumcision?" I'm like, "Okay." So that's how I saw, which I thought was interesting. It wasn't in the room like this.
Uh-huh.
It was in a secluded room with the doctor, the parents, and the baby. That's it. A bunch of medical students.
They actually have, I think I mentioned in the book, right? They have what they call a ritual room.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if it's a Jewish community,
yeah.
They, you know, they have a separate room. It's like a little synagogue chapel almost it's a religious ceremony. Religious ceremony. So that's why, as far as the Jewish community, it doesn't matter if the doctors don't like it. I mean, there will be an eight-day circumcision, you know, and even at a person's home. I mean, it's not that, it's not a, what would you say, a serious surgery or whatever. You can do it at home. I have to say, we had, one of our boys was at the doctor's, our Jewish doctor's office, you know, so he knew perfectly well, and he said, oh yeah, 8 day, come on in. One of our boys though was right at home. The doctor came to our home. So, you know, and believe it or not, I mean, you can understand, it's a time of rejoicing. It's like, sounds weird, it's a party, you know, celebration, and the guys are a little, you know, nauseous or whatever. Okay, I'll leave the room for 15 minutes. But,
did you perform the service on your own son?
No, I wouldn't dare.
He's not trained as a boy.
Yeah, no. I did the Hebrew blessings, you know, but no, we had a Jewish pediatrician, Dr. Stein. Help us out on that one. Yeah, it's oof. I couldn't handle it myself. But don't miss the important point, of course, that it's a beautiful way to dedicate a son. Start, 8 days old, you're already on this religious journey, so to speak. And, all these centuries, the girls were kind of ignored. Not ignored, but there was no need. But, more in recent times, like maybe the last 50 years, the girls are getting equal time to have a dedication ceremony, mm-hmm. whatever. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's no physical surgery or anything, but dedicate the girls at the synagogue and a naming of the girl, and the ladies getting more equal time. So in the old days, just like, ladies,
Is that also done on the eighth day?
Not necessarily. No. So, in fact, we went to a beautiful ceremony of our first granddaughter back in North Carolina, and she was about a month old. But it was kind of like this, the grandparents bring her in, sit her on the lap, say a blessing, and it was very beautiful. So we just did it at the home of my son, and they're part of the Messianic community in Raleigh, North Carolina. So
pretty town.
But so daughters, at least they get that blessing and the naming. So that's about all I'm going to say about circumcision. Okay, so you read the chapter. But let's go on. It's kind of a related life cycle. It's Pidyon HaBen. Again, if you're in the book, page 27. Pidyon means redemption. Ha is the, Ben, son. So redemption of the son. Literally, redemption of the firstborn son. And it's so cool. Again, back to circumcision just for a second. Spiritual lessons. The Bible itself uses it for spiritual lessons. Remove the flesh. Not just the physical. Have a circumcised heart. It talks about that in Deuteronomy 30. So all these ceremonies, even if some of them look a little strange, even the Jews, that's like, I think God's trying to teach us something. So circumcision, new life, covenant with God, sign of the covenant. Well, here we have the second one is redemption of the firstborn. And already you guys can see, this is definitely going to be a picture from God, redemption. And so I have the verse there. It's a number of verses, but Exodus 13, which is right before the Passover. And God is telling Moses, get a lamb, get ready to get out of Egypt with the blood. And you know very well the story of Passover. Mm-hmm. But then he says, all the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Give over to the Lord the first offspring of every womb. So if you follow, the first step is that, you're leaving Egypt, and it's really interesting that the firstborn son was, in a sense, supposed to die, could have died. Pharaoh was trying to kill him, that's for sure. And remember, if you don't have the blood on the house, your firstborn will die. Well, since the Israelites, made it out of Egypt and were saved, he says, now that firstborn belongs to me. The living boy belongs to me. And, of course, God doesn't call for a dead a human sacrifice in that sense of the word, but in other words, the firstborn of the womb, as he puts it here, is to be the priesthood, to serve me. It's really the earliest priesthood. This is before the birth of Levi. Mm-hmm. They'll be the tribe of priests, but So the firstborn son of every family is to be a priest, put it that way. And so what is so interesting about this Pidyon HaBen, and I quote a couple other verses, Numbers 18, it kind of evolves. See if I can make this simple, but Levi comes, one of the tribes, and Levi has said, you're going to be the priest of the tribe of priests. So it kind of put the firstborn guys out of business, so to speak, right? They didn't have to be priest anymore. But God says, you must redeem them. You must buy them back, as it were, redeeming from the Lord. So, and I quoted Numbers 18, it even says 5 shekels, it's obviously a symbolic amount. I mean, the kid's worth a little more than that, but you go to the priest, you get 5 shekels, there's a ceremony, and you can purchase your son back. So what it amounts to is that, let's say in the days of Moses or Levi, that someone has a firstborn son. Oh, I'm supposed to give that to God, but here's a new law from God that I can buy my son back for the family. Mm-hmm. 5 shekels, say a blessing, that kind of thing. Well, again, God doesn't do anything for just busy work. There's a beautiful picture there. Mm-hmm. You guys already see it. It's like paying a price to buy someone back. So I'm sure a lot of people in the early days said, some kind of message there for us about redemption, redeeming the firstborn son. And it's on the 30th day of the boy's, since his birth. So in other words, you have the 8th day circumcision, then on the 30th day, 1 month old, you have this official ceremony, redemption of the firstborn. Now, I do point out also that it's the redemption of the firstborn. So if it's in the book, but if you're taking a couple notes, you want to note 3 things that are necessary to be redeemed. Okay. Not everyone is redeemable, interestingly enough. Okay, so number one, it must be a son. So, sorry ladies, there's no redemption of the daughters. They just got... Just thought the priesthood would be the men, I guess, but so it has to be a son. It has to be a firstborn who is a son. I say that carefully because, in other words, it's as the Torah said, it's the firstborn, first of the womb. It's not like, I've had 3 daughters, and now I've got a son. Now I need to. You don't need to redeem that son. It's only the son, if you have your very first child, is a son. That's the one you redeem.
Like Samuel,
yeah. There's cases in the Bible, yes. So a son who is the firstborn of the mother, and then the final requirement is a non-Levite. Non-Levite, because if the boy is born of a family that's Levites, then he doesn't have a choice. They don't have a choice. He's automatically in the army of the Lord, right? he's in the priesthood. He cannot be bought out of that service. So it's an interesting